The romance of Esther is the best story in the Bible. Whenever I hear it read, read it myself, my mind takes me back to the time before the tradition was set down on parchment, before it was bound into something called a Bible, before it was treated with the reverence and the sanctity associated with the biblical text, to the time in the Orient when the romance of Esther must simply have been one of those idyllic poetic dramas which are told and retold by the professional storytellers of that part of the world. And I can imagine myself in the open colonnade, the forecourt of a Persian synagogue. The children are lying about here or there. The parents, more austere, are sitting quietly, cross-legged on some of those wonderful Oriental rugs. All eyes are on the one man standing in the center of the court, the one who tells tales, the Magid. And he begins without lecturing, without history, without elucidation, as all good storytellers do, that's part of their art, by taking us immediately to the time, to the people about whom the story is told. Once upon a time, the days of King Ahasuerus, you know King Ahasuerus, he was the great emperor Xerxes who ruled from India even to the jungles of Africa. And instead of stopping to tell us something about the time and the place and the history and the politics and the economics and the culture of Persia 500 years before the Common Era, he plunges us immediately into the great majestic palace of Xerxes in Susa. He takes us into the great dining hall of the palace where there's a magnificent feast in process. The king is seated on his throne at the head of the table. His courtiers are all around him. There are mountains of food and gallons of drink, and the king is pretty well at his cups, and he's very boastful, very happy, very self-proud. Who has wealth such as I do? Look around you. Who has power such as I do? Look around you. What brings you here? Who has a wife as beautiful as mine? Look, I'll prove it to you. And he turns to the man standing next to him, the eunuch, his master of his harem, and he says, summon Queen Vashti. Well, the carousing goes on. The courtiers await the entrance of the queen, noted for her beauty, whom no man has ever seen. She has been behind the walls of the harem. There's anticipation in the air when suddenly the master of the harem returns, his voice is quivering. She will not come. Something like this was unheard of in ancient Persia. Woman's lib had not yet come about when women did not know that they could not be merely sex objects. A woman should come when her master calls. And one could see in the courtyard of this Persian synagogue, every man restless in his place. If the king allows Vashti to get away because of her beauty, because of his love for her, with disobedience and defiance, what of my wife in my home? The whole natural order of things will be disturbed. The storyteller goes on. The king hardly blinks an eye. Let her be deposed. No one can violate the will of the king. And so Vashti is sent to anonymity, and messengers are sent about the whole empire of Persia, most of the known world, talent scouts, if you will, to bring back to Susa the most beautiful damoiselles and maidens that can be found. The men are happy. They settle into their places. The world as they know it is secure. And now the storyteller has a dainty for the women. Women like nothing more, it seems, than to be taken, in fact, if not in their imaginations, to the most beautiful spas and beauty salons of the world, to be told the beauty secrets of the Onassises of the world. So we are told, the women of this little synagogue are told, once the women come into the court, they are given each a special hairdresser and each a special maiden to attend to their clothing. And Esther, when she comes to her court, so overwhelms the man who is master of the harem with her beauty that he assigns to her not one particular maid, but seven, not one hairdresser, but the most experienced in the country. And for 6 months, they prescribe for her a special beauty diet, and the women are told the recipe. And they prescribe for her anointing in the elixir, the oil of myrrh, which apparently brings out the radiance of a woman. And for 6 months, she is anointed with the most fragrant perfumes in the land. And these are described in the story. And the women are sitting there on the edge of their seats, taking notes, each one being sure that she will be that much more pleasing to her husband. And sure enough, they have been satisfied. And now both the men and the women are satisfied because the contest takes place and a Jewess is declared fairest of them all. Now, in one such synagogue, one which has survived to us from the second century at Dura Europus, a town way up the Euphrates River in Syria today, the archaeologists found when they excavated the synagogue that there were a series of frescoes all around the wall. And one of the central panels of the fresco depicts a court, a Persian court, and there's a man, an emperor, Ahasuerus, and a woman, Esther, regally on the throne, beautiful in her robes, dressed in the royal purple. Obviously, she occupies a commanding place in the lives, in the thoughts, in the dreams of that generation, that a Jewess could be queen, that a Jewish boy could be president. You know, our generation is not the first that has wanted our crowd to be the in crowd and our ancestors to be the grandees. And so everyone is quite satisfied with the introduction to this tale. The men, the women, the community at large, all are captivated and all are listening. And now he has something for the children, Mannix. Mordecai is Mannix. He is sitting at the gate, and all of a sudden there are two conspirators who have decided, for reasons that are not quite clear, and Mannix is never very clear as to why, that they're going to assassinate the king. And they plot furtively, and Mordecai overhears the plot, and the children are listening. What will happen? What will it be? And Mordecai uncovers a plot and exposes it to the Persian CID, and they bring Bigtan and Teresh before the judge. There is a trial. And then we pause for the commercial. And then there comes on the screen the announcement that on the 14th day of Tebet in the year 412 BC, in the superior court of the city of Susa, Bigtan and Teresh were tried and convicted of the crime of attempted assassination, and they were hung on the gallows of the city. The men, the women, the children are satisfied. And now the storyteller, professional that he is, gets down to the real business of the story. His voice deepens, a tension comes into it, and we are told, as if we're watching the evening news, that the emperor has appointed a new man, Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, as vizier, as prime minister. Why should this news be so darkening, shadowing over the picture? We don't know. But Haman comes on the stage, and we discover that he is a vainglorious man. He wants not only power, but all the trappings of power. He has an overwhelming ego. In Persia, when a man approached the king, he had to bow down and to prostrate himself as a sign of respect and honor. And one did that to no other man. But as prime minister, Haman immediately orders that all who approach him must bow down and prostrate themselves. And of course, when a man has power in a dictatorship, people are careful to cater to his whims. One man will not. And that man is Mordecai, the Jew, the uncle of Esther, so recently crowned as queen. Now, in the Orient, men learn craft and men learn cunning. Men learn to be devious in their acts and to take their time to plot revenge against those who cross their way. They lived in a world of tyranny, where one couldn't simply go out and make a reasonable case for one's position and hope that it would carry the day. And even Haman, as vizier, does not immediately order Mordecai's head to be cut off. He takes counsel with himself. How shall I do Mordecai in the most effectively? And he develops a plan. And we see the Council of State the next day, and the meeting is over, and the vizier approaches the emperor, and he says, Shah of Shahs, I have a request to make of you. Speak on, my counselor. I have here 10,000 talents of silver. It's a great deal of money, as you know. I am prepared to offer this to you as my sign of loyalty, because I want to do an act which is for your advantage. What is that, my vizier? There is in the country a people, not a large people, but a people who are recalcitrant and rebellious, who will not be managed, who will not offer to you the signs of loyalty and obedience and of homage. Let me pay you this sum of money and sign for me with your great seal a document which will give these people into my power, and I will dispose of them, and there will be peace in your empire. Now, a tyrant cares very little about the lives of people. He has absolute power, and he has been absolutely corrupted by that power. Ahasuerus doesn't ask, who are this people? What are the crimes? What are the proof of the charges that you bring? He has an army to pay. He has a court to feed. He sees the advantage of the 10,000 talents of silver. And being an Oriental, he knows that Haman will confiscate the property of this particular people, and he will get back the money and probably a good bit more. There is advantage to both. What does it count if a few tens of thousands of people are hung or have their throats slit? And he signs the great seal. With the great seal, the document of death, of genocide. And the Jews, as yet unnamed, are destined for death. Now you can see the tension mounting in the listeners. Mordecai hears of the great signing. What shall he do? He turns to Esther. He gets word to her of the event. All rests with you, my queen. You are the one who has the ear of the king. And Esther is not quite sure what to do. She is willing to speak, but if anyone enters into the audience chamber of the Shah of Shahs unannounced and uninvited, he risks his own life. His own life is forfeit if the king does not lift up his scepter as a sign of welcome. She asked Mordecai and her people to pray for her and to fast for her for 3 days. And in the meantime, the storyteller turns to the stories within the story, which add so much to the plot. Mordecai leaves the palace with the rescript in his arms, and he passes, Haman leaves the palace, and he passes Mordecai in the hallway. And he cannot see Mordecai. He sees only his own anger, his own bitterness, his own determination. The sight of Mordecai only increases his desire to be done with this, to have his way, to have his bloodlust assuaged. He goes home, and he orders a great gallows, 75 feet high, to be raised in his own courtyard. He will have the pleasure of watching the death throes of the hated Jew. 3 days pass. The queen has no alternative. She has not been summoned. She has no alternative but to appear in the royal court. She dresses in all her finery. She anoints herself with myrrh and with perfume, and she enters into the throne room. Wonderfully, the king is delighted to see her. He is pleased and flattered that the queen has come. Vashti would not come. Esther is willing to come and to be seen. What will you, my queen? Ask. You have but to ask, and I will grant it. And Esther says with her best voice and her best smile, my lord, I ask only that you attend me a few days hence at a banquet. I will prepare for you my own apartments. And if you wish, she adds, bring your vizier with you. He will help make conversation. The king is pleased. Haman is delighted. Obviously, the queen knows where power lies in the court. They both readily accept. And Haman rushes off home to tell the good news of his triumph, of the recognition of his rank and power by the queen. And one has the sense that the fate of the Jews is destined and sealed and inevitable. But that night, the king cannot sleep. And he orders one of the masters of his bedchamber to take out the chronicles of the kingdom and to read him to sleep. And lo and behold, the master opens the book to the place which details the act of loyalty done by Mordecai so many years before. How Mordecai had uncovered the plot to assassinate the king and risked his own life in order to expose it. And the emperor reminds himself that no reward had been given to Mordecai at that time. And the next day, after the Council of State, he turns to Haman, his vizier, and he says to him, "What should I do to a man whom I delight to honor?" And being the popinjay, the vainglorious person that he was, Haman can believe only that the emperor is interested in honoring him even more. What would he like? The people prostrate themselves before him. He'd like to wear the garments of the king. He'd like to be dressed to ride on the horse of the king and to be paraded as if he were emperor down the great processional streets, the main streets of Susa. Let that be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. "So shall it be," the king says. "Take Mordecai, and you as prime minister, lead him on my horse dressed in my royal purple robes through the streets of Susa." Imagine Haman's consternation and anger and frustration. But in a tyranny, one obeys. One makes no comment. And he leads Mordecai through the streets. This is his last moment. I'll have the last word. And he rushes home bitter and angry. But every good story should have its moment of chilling premonition. He pours out his anger to his wife, and her only response is, "If Mordecai be a Jew, you shall never have your way over his people." The voice of the witches in Macbeth, the voice of doom, the sudden intrusion of a possibility that the Jews will be freed and that the fate which Haman has decided to determine on for them has been in fact determined for him. The day of the great dinner comes. People inch forward in their seats to hear what will happen. There's a beautiful table set, lovely terrace in front of Esther's apartment. The servants bring in the most delicate and dainty of foods. It is a delightful banquet. Everyone is in good humor, and nothing happens. Nothing at all happens. "My queen," as the emperor says as he's about to leave, "ask, you have but to ask, and I will grant you. I ask only, my king, that you return another night for another banquet, which I will prepare for you and for your vizier." Storyteller builds up the climax. He draws out the attention of the audience as long as he can, the second banquet. He has another chance to describe a beautiful royal table and all of the majestic foods fit only for the palate of an emperor. He describes it. Everyone is enjoying himself and everyone is relaxed. And the king, as he is about to leave after this wonderful repast, says to the queen, "Ask, my beloved, what shall I grant you? You have only to ask, and I will honor your petition." Tinatein li nafshi, v'ami b'vakashti. Grant me, my lord, my own life. My people, that's my request. Your life, your people, what are you asking for? How is your life threatened? Who threatens it? Mihuze. No words this time. The finger. The queen's finger pointed directly at Haman, who crouches in terror. For a minute, he doesn't understand. And then the light dawns. Esther must be a Jewess. She's pleading for the life of the people whom the king has given into his power. And then, of course, the denouement, the climax. Haman, he was swinging, while Mordecai was singing in Shushu, Shushu, Shushan long ago. Melodrama, TV, call it what you will. a great moment of relief. The danger is past. These people, a diaspora people, an exiled people sitting in their court, listening to the once to the tale of once upon a time, transfer once upon a time, to their insecurity. And in the rejoicing of Purim, they rejoice that for that year, that moment, their lives seem to be at peace. Now, the longer I live and study the traditions of our people, the more I'm convinced of this, that behind every so-called fact, everything that seems to be, there is a paradox. And the paradox of Purim is this, that there probably was no Esther, there probably was no Mordecai, there certainly was no king of Persia named Ahasuerus. There may not have been a prime minister named Haman. All of it may be the invention of a folk teller, the wedding of some traditional Oriental 1001 night themes. There may have been no original Purim, but there were, in fact, many Purim. It's a case in which fiction prophesies what fact is and will be. There have been many times in Jewish history when someone in power became angry with or avaricious enough to wish to destroy, to exterminate, to expropriate the property of this people. And there have been times, not every time, but there have been times when there was a sudden deliverance, an unexpected occurrence which delivered the people from an announced fate. In community after community in Asia, the Near East, in Europe, the communities celebrated their own special Purims, which had an historical base. In Shiraz, in Persia, on the second day of Heshvan of every year, they celebrated the Purim of Shiraz. And why did they celebrate the Purim of Shiraz? Because 1,000 years before, there had been in their city a Jew, a no-goodnik, who had been the kosher butcher of the city, and he had sold meat that was not properly slaughtered, and he had sold tainted meat which was unhealthy and which caused illness, and he had been exposed by those who were responsible for the regulation of the Jewish marketplace, and in his anger and his bitterness, he had turned Muslim, and in order to make it seem as if he were now, he was an honest man who had been maligned by the Jews, he began to tell the most pernicious stories about the Jews of Shiraz. They murdered Muslim children. They were guilty of all manner of the worst kind of action. Tensions mounted in the city. Finally, the caliph of Shiraz issued an order demanding the exile of all of Shiraz's Jews. And then Abu al-Hassan, this renegade, was struck down by the plague. And riddled with guilt on his deathbed, he confessed that he had maligned and lied about his people, and the edict of expulsion of the Jews of Shiraz was rescinded. If you go to Hebron, in the West Bank, in Israel, the Jews of Hebron observed a Purim, a special Purim of Hebron, for 1,500 years. And it had to do with an event way back in early Muslim times, when the man, the vazir, who was the Muslim head of the community, demanded of the Jewish community in 3 days some 100 talents of silver, more money than the Jews could possibly have raised in 3 years. There was no chance to raise this money. And he threatened the Jew that if they did not raise the required sum, he would kill them all. What should you do? A meeting was called. People laid bare whatever money was available. It didn't begin to measure up to the sum that was needed. But strangely, on this third night, as the Jewish watchman of the Jewish quarter of the city was making his rounds around that quarter, convinced in his own mind that this would be the last time he would ever take these appointed rounds, his toe stubbed against a box. He opened the box and he found in it a sum of silver equal to 100 talents. And the money was brought to the Muslim official, and he was bought off, and the community was saved. A few years later, on his deathbed, so the story goes, this Muslim official confessed to his imam, to his religious leader, that when he had issued that edict of expulsion, the angel of death had come to him and said, if you touch the hair of a single Jew, your own life is forfeit. And he had caused that coffer to be placed in the round, on the path that he knew the sentry must follow, that it should be found and that the Jews should be freed. However, deliverance came. It came in strange ways, and sometimes it didn't come. But when it came, the Jews rejoiced. Purim speaks of the basic insecurity of Jewish life, that we lived on the razor's edge. And it says something about the relief, the release, the emotional release which came to our people when suddenly deliverance would come. Now, I call this sermon, again, the question of survival. I did so deliberately. Jews today can see insecurity around the borders of Israel. And we can see the insecurity of the condition of the Jews of the Soviet Union. We all agree on that. There's no problem here. But as American Jews, we somehow feel that the Purim message is not quite relevant to us. Insecurity is not the basic dimension of our lives as Jews. We feel secure in this nation. It has been good to us. Oh yes, there were prejudices brought over from the old world. There were places we could not go and businesses we could not enter and jobs which were denied to us and names which were sometimes called us. But education and prosperity and the American spirit would somehow cause these to disappear little by little from the land. And as we looked about ourselves these last 30 years or more, we became convinced that this was in fact what was happening. The voice of the anti-Semite was muted. The areas in which we could not buy homes were diminished until they were hardly consequential. The number of places where we couldn't find jobs became fewer and fewer. And we came to the conviction that, in fact, America was different, or rather that Jewish life in America was not one where the question of survival would be foremost. And there were serious debates about 30, 20 years ago, rabbinic conferences and elsewhere, as to whether or not we shouldn't simply do away with Purim. The Book of Purim is a story. It has no deep moral or ethical lesson. What do we do really with Purim? We turn it into carnival time. We don't turn it into a great moral moment. It has no meaning in this environment. If we want to maintain it as an historical anomaly, all right. But does it speak to us? The answer came back, it doesn't seem to. But I wonder. I wonder why in the last 5 years we've seen the birth of a Jewish Defense League whose motto is never again. Well, you said to me, this has to do with paranoia. This has to do with a few problems of the poor, which were overlooked, which will be taken care of now. It has to do with the ego needs and the ambitions of one or two men who had been denied positions of power and leadership by the organized Jewish community. And all this may be so. But people came to a Jewish Defense League. And there were places in this country where Jews felt it necessary to have vigilante groups patrolling their neighborhoods to prevent attack on their synagogues, on their yeshivot, on their persons. Time marches on. And just this last year, just these last months, I note the creation of an organization called the Jewish National Security, Community Security Council. Jewish Community Security Council. And the leaders of this group are not the Mayor Kahans, and not the unknown, and not the semi-educated, but they are the professors of our seminaries, some of the leading rabbis in the New York and Eastern areas, some of the traditional leaders of our American Jewish community. Why should Jews now be organizing community security councils? And I pick up the magazine which is sponsored by the American Jewish Committee, Commentary. If you read the last issue of Commentary, you find a very strange phenomenon. The American Jewish Committee has for years represented the most secure Jews in this country, those who felt that Jews ought not to protest, ought not to organize for politically for particular Jewish interests. One had these interests, but they could be handled through personal contact. These were the establishment Jews. And Commentary magazine has over the years represented a kind of superior patronizing attitude towards the proletariat, towards the proletarian needs of ordinary Jews. But the lead editorial by Norman Podhoretz in this month's issue of Commentary magazine is a striking one. For he raises the question whether the old phrase, "Is it good for the Jews?" ought not to be a phrase, a judgment, a standard which Jews, his Jews, commentary kinds of Jews, begin to raise again. And he points out on a number of articles which have appeared in this magazine over the last year, there has become clear evidence of a new kind of discrimination against Jews, and a new kind of tolerance of openly anti-Semitic statement, if not activity. He points to the growing violence of certain kinds of anti-Semitic statements on the far fringes of the New Left, in certain parts of the civil rights movement. He points to the kind of academic anti-Semitism, which is beginning to appear. He quotes Truman Capote, a famous author, who in a public statement attacked what he called the Jewish literary mafia, the Jews who he said control the mass media in New York and who prevent any non-Jewish author from gaining the stature, the exposure that he deserves. He points to what he calls the affirmative action programs of our government, well-intentioned programs designed to promote the future, the opportunity for minority groups, the programs which require that those who already occupy supervisory positions be moved over or be moved down, programs which require that school teachers in an area which is being given over to local control represent the minority in local control, therefore threatening the livelihoods, the years of investment, the pension rights, the security of Jewish teachers or of other teachers in the area. He points to the increasing unwillingness of college faculties to appoint Jews because they are under the pressure to appoint minorities from which Jews are obviously excluded, because they are under pressure to see to it that there are proportional kinds of representation in all fields on their campus. And he wonders aloud whether or not one of the questions the Jew of America must begin to ask is the question that Jews have asked throughout the centuries but have not felt it necessary to ask here. Is it good for the Jew? Are these programs which we have devised in the name of advancement, in the name of change, in the name of necessary progress, are they being done at the cost of a particular minority, of a particular small group of people? Are we the ones who are to bear the cost of change in America? Is it simply a Jewish area in which scattered housing is to be built, as in Crown Heights in New York? Why did the government, Lindsay's government, pull back from 8 areas which were not primarily Jewish areas and go ahead only with those which were? Why is it that it is peculiarly in an area like New York that these tensions have surfaced? Because there you have a large Jewish minority which cannot simply escape into the suburbs, which does not have great economic security. what's happening in New York at the moment? The state legislature has had before it a special bill to preclude local poverty councils from holding elections on the Sabbath. Why? Because in the last 3 or 4 years, they have chosen to hold elections on the Sabbath, which is simply a convenient way of precluding the traditional Jew, the Orthodox Jew, a very large segment in the poor areas of New York, from voting for these councils and therefore from getting appropriate representation on them. The Jews in the United States are not threatened by Haman. The Jews in the United States are not threatened by any edict ordering death or expulsion. Our lives are more secure than the lives of any Jewish community, I suspect, of the diaspora in all of our history. But that is not to say that our lives are secure, that we have made it, that we are not an identifiable minority against whom other power groups can turn and will turn when it is to their advantage. And if Purim, this Purim, is to have any meaning, I suspect it is in a growing recognition on the part of all of us who are concerned with necessary changes in American life, with all that passes under the term progress, social progress. It is necessary for us to recognize that we cannot be so pell-mell concerned with change that we exchange what we have now for a much worse position for our children. For it is completely feasible and imaginable that their lives will have far less opportunity than ours have had because they will live in a world where various groups are competing openly for position and power, and some groups have found that one can turn the screws on a particular minority, the Jew, and turn them to advantage. In a more positive way, what's the lesson of Purim? The first is to learn to live with insecurity. That's the very nature of life, I suspect. And the second is to live with pride in one's own nature and one's own being. To learn to take advantage of that which is in the Jewish tradition, in our rich literature, in our rich ceremonial, in our worship, in our study, to take advantage of it so that the label, the name, the political liability, all these do not bother us over much. What does the heroism of Esther consist? That she did not hide who she was. Whatever had happened to the Jews of Persia long ago, she would have been secure. She could have ridden out the storm. But she's willing to stand up and to say, Ivri Anochi, I am a Hebrew. Well, we are willing to get up and to say, I am a Hebrew. But many of us, I suspect, have no positive content to the term. It's simply the label that we bear. We haven't tried to make it the soul that beats within us. We haven't tried to feed the Hebrew spirit. And so we think of Jewish life in almost socio-political terms without thinking of it in spiritual terms, without thinking of it in terms of learning and the things which bring satisfaction to the soul. We see this in Jewish life. Our national institutions are burgeoning and growing, and there's great interest to them. Our religious institutions, our libraries, our research institutions, these tend not to be attended. These tend not to be as thriving at this moment in time. And we Jews are going out simply with the label to try and preserve, to fight the hard fight of survival. And I am fearful that that fight will be so unremitting, as it has always been, that unless we nourish the soul, we replenish the spirit, we will find ourselves dispirited and broken, brittle, unable to persevere over the long, long haul. Well, tonight, this afternoon, in the depths of the temple, there'll be all the shouts of young joy as the games and the wheels are spun and the games are played. Purim will again be a celebration. Our young have no idea why. They like a good time. They enjoy it fully. We enjoy it, their enjoyment. But there's a more sober line to this holiday we call Purim. And I've tried to lay it out to you. The insecurity of life, particularly now of Jewish life, the tensions of living, the need to define oneself and have pride in that definition, the need to accept oneself and to turn to that which can give encouragement within the tradition, and to draw from it, to drink of it, to feed on it. There's a great library in this temple. Beautiful services here everywhere. The Jews will only take advantage of them. Amen.